They toil in obscurity, and happily so, it turns out. There are lots of people who have very important jobs, and you just don't hear about them. If you do, it's probably because something went wrong. Those are the cases in which the invisibles become visible. Invisibles? That's what today's guest calls them in his book. David Zweig is the author of Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. David Zweig finds several outlets for his talents. His writing includes works for The Atlantic and other publications you've heard of. His debut novel got good reviews, and he has released two albums as singer, guitarist, and producer. David Zweig, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me on.
So in any of these roles, have you been an invisible?
Well, I mean, one of the main things about the book is that the final message really is that in the end, it doesn't matter how visible or invisible you are. It's really about a certain mindset that all these people share. I don't want to give too much away, but that really is what it comes to in the end. So, yeah, I've always had a little bit of invisibility in all of my roles. But the inspiration for the book was that I used to work as a magazine fact checker for a number of years. And, you know, the thing about that job is the better you do that job, the more you disappear. So, you know, when's the last time you've read a great magazine article and thought to yourself, man, this was fact checked beautifully? You know, it's only if I made a mistake that anyone would ever think of me at all. And I thought, this is so strange. We're in a culture where people want attention more than anything else. That's how we're told we're going to feel good about ourselves, and that's how you get ahead. And yet, I felt really rewarded doing that job, and I wanted to find out if there were other professions that shared this same kind of inverse relationship between work and recognition.
You, in one of your stints, were you at The New Yorker? I know you talked about in the book about fact checkers at The New Yorker.
Yeah, no, I was not at The New Yorker, though I was at Condé Nast, you know, which is
owns
The New Yorker.
Sure.
Yeah, and I worked at a variety of magazines in Condé Nast. So I saw The New Yorker folks in the cafeteria.
And I'm surprised at how big a staff of fact checkers they have.
Yeah, it's The New Yorker, you know, is obviously either the most or certainly in the top, you know, two or three most prestigious magazines in the country, I think most people would say, and they and they have a commensurate fact-checking department. You know, the sad thing is that a lot of magazines today are really have cut back on their fact-checking, and it's to a certain degree kind of non-existent at newspapers and other media outlets. They do fact-checking, but they don't have the dedicated staff. You know, the editors and stuff kind of double up on the fact-checking, but it's really almost the exclusive area of these sort of high-end magazines, you know, weekly and monthly magazines that really employ a dedicated staff whose sole purpose is to just comb through every article and make sure everything is correct.
That is quite impressive when you consider the number of people that are employed in the fact-checking department at The New Yorker. And they all sound quite accomplished. These are not people who just came out of community college or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's the amazing thing about the people who I focus on in the book, that, you know, there have been plenty of books written about these sort of anonymous workers toiling away at a factory or people of that nature, and those people are important and deserve to be written about. But what I was interested in were people who had the means to do a variety of different things, people who are highly educated, very ambitious, who were really skilled in a certain area, and yet they chose to work behind the scenes. They chose to work in a role where they were really kind of behind a front person, or their work would never really be noticed by the end user. And that, to me, was just this really fascinating notion of what kind of person chooses to do something where they're not going to get attention and thrives there.
Well, and two quick examples that you give in the book. I mean, we're not talking about movie stars, but the people who make movie stars look great with lights and lenses. And we're not talking about the airline pilots, the flyboys. We're talking about the people who get you to find the plane because they put up the good signs in the airports. And these are jobs that really are critical, but you just don't think about them.
Yeah. So one of the people who I profile in the book is a man named Robert Elswit. Most of the listeners probably have never heard of his name, but Robert Elswit is one of the top cinematographers working today. He's won an Oscar for There Will Be Blood, the Paul Thomas Anderson movie, and he's worked on a number of really big commercial films as well, stuff in the Bourne Identity franchise and Mission Impossible. And the amazing thing about him is that here's a guy who's paid very handsomely for his work. He is, you know, a really successful, basically at the top of his field. I thought he would have this big kind of Hollywood attitude, but in fact, he was very personable. He's very friendly. And when you see that long scroll of names at the end of a film, you're like, who are all these people? A good chunk of them are underneath his charge, the gaffers, the grips, and all these people. And so here's a guy who really is a leader. He's in charge of a lot of people. He's paid well. He has a really important role in the films. After the director, no one has a bigger impact on the look and feel of a movie than the cinematographer does. And yet, his chapter, I call it the singular vision and the art of collaboration. He's really a master collaborator. For him, he doesn't want to be known. He doesn't want the audience to even think about him or what he's doing. It's all about making the director and the film look great.
And he's really good at his craft. We'll talk more about other people who are invisibles. The book is called Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. And the relentless self-promotion gets a few chapters in the book as well. We'll talk more with David Zweig, the author, and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is David Zweig, author, musician, and more. He is the author of a book called Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. It's a book about the people who toil behind the scenes, love what they do, do a really good job at it, and you will never, ever hear of them unless something goes wrong. We'll talk about that later in the program. You can join us on the exchange. Maybe talk about some people that you know who have been invisibles. Maybe you yourself have had one of these jobs. Not thankless, mundane tasks, but things that are important, just you don't do it in the public eye. 800-838-3760, the phone number around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And again, you point out this is not about thankless, mundane jobs. You've made that clear already. But people who you know, may not necessarily want to draw attention to themselves. But, I mean, this is an issue that you raise at the outset of the book. I mean, how many people really want jobs like that or think they do anyway?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of people like this, and I think they're basically in every field and in every industry. And in the book, I profile people. I took a really wide lens view to find people across, you know, a really disparate range of fields. And yet I found that they all share certain traits. So one of the things is that, one, there are a lot of these people. But the reason we may not think that there are a lot is because what I talk about in the book is because of this broader kind of ethos today in our culture, where attention seems to be valued above nearly everything else, where we're told in order to get ahead, you need to raise your profile or, you know, build a platform. And we're told that to feel good about ourselves, that you always need attention. Look at everyone, you know, with social media today. There's just so much involved that this kind of norm today that people are supposed to share everything about themselves, where the only metric of value is how many likes you get, you know, is the amount of attention you get. So the two things are that, one, there are a lot of these people, but two, the rest of us, I think, are being led astray by, you know, what I talk about is this kind of myth that we think that you need all this attention in order to become successful and also in order to feel fulfilled, and it's really not the case.
So these people are essentially getting their strokes from ways other than people gushing about them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's not that the people are, you know, against being recognized. And in fact, the people who I purposely, you know, profile in the book, I chose people who are really at the top of their fields. So these are people who are recognized within their own space that they work in, among colleagues and peers and others. So it's not that they are, you know, meek or hiding in the corner. It's simply that they have an ambivalence toward recognition, which is kind of the core trait of all of these people. They just simply don't seek attention the way it seems so many of us do.
And other examples we want to give here. One of the first names mentioned in the book is that of Andy Johns, a recording engineer. And he actually has delivered one of the most famous sounds in recent recording history. And yet you probably never know the name.
Yeah, that's right. I love the anecdote about Andy Johns. He was a recording engineer, and he worked with a ton of really, really important bands, basically like cultural touchstones of a generation, Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, and all the way up through the years through like Van Halen and others. And he recorded that famous drum sound at the beginning of When the Levee Breaks. But no one would ever know this guy's name unless you're a real, you know, hardcore music studio buff. And for him, the reward was in doing the work of being a behind the scenes worker. And in fact, there's a story, who knows how true this is, but there's a story that he was actually offered to be in the Rolling Stones, possibly replacing Bill Wyman on bass, and he turned the band down.
Really?
Because he wanted to continue doing what he did. He knew what he loved, and that was just working in the room, you know, on the control board and engineering records.
Wow. Well, and there are times when the visibles do become visible, because in thinking about Andy Johns, I was forced to think about Alan Parsons, who is anything but invisible and has been for 30 years now, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but the thing is, you know, as I think I stated at the outset when we were talking, you know, in the end, it's really not even about how much we're seen or not. You know, the people I profile in the book, this is not an exclusive group. It's not like you either are or are not an invisible. It's really about a certain mindset. So, in fact, there are plenty of CEOs of companies and other really visible people who still embody these invisible traits, this notion of focusing on the work more than the recognition for it. Another trait that they have is meticulousness. And a third core trait is that these people all tend to what I call savor responsibility, that despite the fact that a lot of people won't know they have this responsibility behind the scenes, that they want that role. Most of us, it seems like, you know, we view responsibility as a burden, yet these people view it as an honor. They want to take that role on. So it, in the end, it really doesn't even matter about how much you're seen or not. You can think about, you know, a star quarterback who is silently studying game film night after night leading up to Sunday, or the overnight sensation pop star who is playing dive bars for a decade first. These are really invisible traits in the end as I define them. But in the book, of course, I focus on people who really are invisibles.
Well, and then, you know, there's an interesting quote in here. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around. Could be argued that a culture of recognition dovetails with a culture of excessive supervision.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the arguments I make in the book, is that this notion where, you know, and again, it's not exclusive to social media, but I think that's a really big driver of this, that when you're in an environment where I was saying the main metric of value is attention. You know, most of us, I think you put something online, you're always secretly hoping for more and more likes and hoping for ever more followers. And it feels like a little bit of a failure when you put something online that doesn't get attention. That is just an entirely unhealthy way of living. But yet that is the environment. That's the metric we're given for what is considered important or valuable. Valuable is the amount of attention you get online. So this notion that everyone is striving for more and more attention, and that has a correlation with, ultimately, with this kind of supervision culture, where if you're expecting to share everything and wanting everything to be seen, then it becomes more permissive for more of you to be seen. The notion of what's public and private, I think, begins to change.
When you talk about social media in here, David, I'm starting to combine the decades here. Just imagine what it would have been like if say Andy Johns had been about self-promotion. If he had a Twitter feed back in 1971 when he recorded Zeppelin, it would have been OMG, I just recorded the most awesome drum sound. # Led Zepp.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and there's I'm on social media. There's a lot of things about it that are terrific. So the book is not about saying that promotion is bad or that attention is bad. Far from that. It's we all need to promote ourselves in certain times and in certain circumstances. There's nothing wrong with that. But again, you know, what Andy Johns showed was that when you really focus on the work itself, that when this what psychologists call an intrinsic reward, rather than extrinsic rewards, which are things like money or attention, that these intrinsic rewards really offer the most deep and lasting value to us, well beyond what we can get from attention. That's always fleeting. It doesn't last.
David Zweig is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. It's about people who toil in obscurity. They do really good jobs. Their jobs are really important, but they don't necessarily need the recognition for it. So you generally don't hear about them unless something goes wrong. 800-838-3760 around the region if you'd like to join our conversation. In the Rogue Valley, you can call 541-552-6782. You can email us at jx@jeffnet.org. So one of the first jobs that were first occupations, actually, that were brought to view in the book is wayfinding, which the title alone is fun. But what does wayfinding involve?
Well, wayfinding is the field of the person who is at the center of the profile is a man named Jim Harding. And he is a wayfinding expert, and these are the people who help you navigate or, quote, find your way in really large, complex environments like airports or hospitals or even cities. So I met up with Jim at Atlanta's airport, which is the busiest airport in the world, and at the International Terminal, which is what he worked on there. And we went around, and he showed me, and we talked about really this whole world that is happening in an airport that we're unaware of, that all the they study which type of typefaces to use on the signs, which ones are the most legible from a distance. They figure out which pictograms to use, you know, that symbol of the, quote, universal man you see on the door of the restroom. That's not just chosen arbitrarily. And, in fact, I have some really fun images in the book where you can see how the image for woman in the Geneva airport is actually this more slightly more curvy and, if you will, sexy figure than the one who's at, like, the Frankfurt airport, for mm-hmm. example, who has a longer skirt on it. So we think when you're just looking at these images that it's just kind of, oh, that's the generic one. But there's actually an enormous amount of attention. But what's really amazing about wayfinding is actually that when it's at its best, it has nothing to do with signs. It's when they sort of usher us from one place to the next without us even realizing it. And there are all sorts of subtle, even subconscious cues that wayfinders use, like different types of light and color, angling the aisles in a certain way that kind of usher us without us even being aware of it to kind of keep things moving and get us to where we need to go. It's really just an incredible science and craft. And of course, as you know, Jim said to me, he said, listen, no one's ever going to leave a note in a, you know, in an airport comment box saying, hey, thanks, I got to my gate really easily. For him, invisibility really is a sign of honor, he told me. You know, this is when I'm perfect, no one's thinking about me. You only think about the signs and stuff in an airport if something goes wrong, if you get lost. But when you get to where you need to go easily, then his job is done, even though you never think of him. So again, it begs the question, where is his reward? You know, for most of us, we want more attention. Hey, we do a great job as a writer. You know, if I do a great job, I get nice reviews. My name's on the cover of my book. It's nice. But for someone like him, the better job he does, the more he disappears. And that's what's really amazing about his wayfinding, and that one of the people in the book is a guy who, a man named Dennis Poon, who's a structural engineer on many of the world's tallest skyscrapers. We always think of the architect when you see a great building, but particularly in these big skyscrapers, without the engineers like this guy Dennis Poon, these buildings would never stand. And yet, he, whenever I ask him a question about himself, he would always answer, we, instead of I.
For
this
his
is
team?
A guy who's on the board of directors of a global engineering firm in charge of billion, with a B, billion-dollar projects, huge teams of workers, and yet he got there by having this kind of opposite approach from what we think you need in order to become successful, by viewing himself as a member of a team, by caring more about the project. So that's what's amazing when you see these different people, like Jim Harding, the wayfinding guy, or the structural engineer, and all these really different industries, that they share these certain traits that really teach all of us, I know I learned a lot along the way, but teach all of us kind of something about the meaning of success, how to become successful, and also about what it means to be fulfilled.
The fulfillment comes from just knowing that the job is well done. In Dennis Poon's case, it was really interesting for me to think about, oh, wait a minute, the architect says, well, it's going to look like this, but he's really the guy who has to figure out what materials to use to make this, to pull off the architect's vision.
That's right. And when you're at his level of engineering, they really have a big impact on the aesthetics of the building as well. That, you know, people don't realize this, but the engineers really affect how these super tall, you know, and complex buildings, how they're created. So the engineering is really, you know, it's a kind of form and function married together. But again, of course, you know, I challenge any of your listeners to actually name a structural engineer. yet they're enormously important to these skylines, these iconic buildings, both civic and national pride. I met up with him in China at a building called the Shanghai Tower. This is the second tallest building in the world. And I'm there with him while it's under construction. We're, you know, 80 stories up. There are no windows there. It's just me and him kind of like clinging to a, you know, unfinished column next to me as the wind is like rippling by us. And you just kind of really absorb the importance of this guy's work, that the soundness of these buildings really rests on his and his team's calculations. This guy has an enormous amount of responsibility, and yet, again, I mentioned this earlier, you know, for him, the responsibility is an honor. It's not something to shy away from, even though he knows that the average person, the user of these buildings, will never think of him. And just like Robert Elswit, he knows the person who's watching a film, they're not thinking of a cinematographer. He just wants them to be in the moment. Jim Harding, you know, at the airport. So each of these people, well, you know, if nothing else, what I hope the book shows is that you're never going to enter an airport the same way again after reading this book. You will never watch a movie the same way again. You will never look at a skyscraper the same way again. So I had these people in all these different industries where I'm really trying to kind of pull back the curtain, and you can really see what's going on in a way that you never were aware of before.
You really will notice things that you didn't notice before. Let's take a call. Here's Alan Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Zweig, the author of The Invisibles, or just Invisibles.
Hey,
not the...
Jeffrey, this is Al Peterson calling.
Hey, Al.
You and I both worked in TV news for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always amazed that every time somebody won an award for some fine journalistic work they did, that the reporter and the photographer always got congratulated. But the assignment editor, at least half the time, gave them everything they needed. Nobody ever says thank you. Nobody ever says great job. And the general manager comes down and talks to the reporter and says great work. I've always found that kind of amazing. So when I did win an award or two, I'd always try to thank the assignment editor. But it's they kind of keep the whole thing running, and it's a really hard job. Unfortunately, you know, you don't get much credit for it. And I guess I'm amazed looking back that nobody seemed to resent it. Maybe they fit in that category. I'll just listen to your comments off the air.
All right. Thanks for that, Al. Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Well, I should point out that the producer of the Jefferson Exchange, Charlotte Duran, was herself a TV assignment editor for the better part of a year, and can certainly relate to the kinds of things Al's talking about. I mean, this is another one of these cases, David, where somebody says, here you go. This is the stuff you need to do your job. And then, poof, they're back to their desk and off to the next thing.
Yeah, I mean, and how amazing is that? I mean, what a powerful lesson, you know, about what really ultimately brings us fulfillment. You know, this notion that most of us, and, you know, you're on the air, you're on the radio, and, you know, and now as a writer, we get recognition. But even for someone like me, what I found is that, and while I'm having a great time talking with you, and it's fun, you know, going on TV shows and stuff, what really brings me the lasting reward is just digging into my work, you know, when I'm just doing the research, and I'm meeting with people, and doing the writing. Because in the end, this is going to end. You know, I spent roughly 2 years or so working on this book, and I'm going to spend 2 months promoting it. So all the attention, that's going to fade, and it always goes away. So you have to tap into something. So you're talking about your, you know, the producer on the show, and she's working as an assignment editor. There's perhaps something in the blood there, you know, and that's what I kind of talk about in the book, that there's something that some of these people have figured out that they've really tapped into about what brings them reward. And I suspect none of them want to be ignored or not respected or acknowledged for their work, but they just simply don't need that. They just don't thrive on the praise and the attention that it seems like so many of us, you know, feel like we're told that we need to do. So the book kind of gives a lot of people permission in a way to sort of like step off the wheel, you know, that it's like there's this constant pressure for so many people, particularly professionally, to have to promote themselves. One of the editors I met with when we were sending the proposal for my book around, there are a number of different publishers who are interested, and we're talking with them. And this editor said to me, yeah, you know, my boss wants me to have a Twitter account. She's like, I don't want to be online doing that. She said, I'm an editor. My job is to be behind the scenes. So, and she, there's this kind of, the book, I think, taps into this resentment and anxiety that a certain amount of people feel, that they just don't want to be doing this stuff, but they're told that they have to. And my book sort of says, hey, you don't have to do that.
Indeed, the age of relentless self-promotion. The book is called Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. We'll talk more with David Zweig and take more of your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today to David Zweig. He's the author of a book about people who toil in obscurity, and they're okay with that because they have very important jobs. They really have a level of detail they need to get to. They have traits like ambivalence to recognition, devotion to meticulousness, and they savor responsibility. He calls them invisibles. His book is called Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. This is almost an alien concept we were just bringing up before the break here, David, the idea of work as its own reward, which doesn't seem to be a hugely popular concept in this world we live in today, certainly in the American part of it.
Yeah, that's a really good point, there is something in the culture where simply there, what I talk about in the book is that for, you know, many years, you can look back at American history, we really had this well-balanced duality, I think, of traits that's led to kind of this American success. One side is this, you can go back to sort of the puritanical, nose to the grindstone, you know, roots a few hundred years ago, and you follow this kind of what David Foster Wallace called the quiet dignity of the average American, just doing the work, the company man of the last century, just getting the job done. And that has been balanced by this American noise, our Hollywood Klieg lights shining to the world, you know, Cornelius Vanderbilt and the Gilded Age and these wild sideburns he had, if you think about pictures of him. There's this great kind of duality. But what I argue is, and I give quite a few examples of this about where you can track this over time, what I argue is that today that we've become out of balance, and there's far, far more emphasis and value placed on the American noise and far less based on quiet dignity of just doing the work. And I think that's both to our personal as well as more cultural and even economic detriment.
Let us take a call. We have Silverman in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Zweig, author of Invisibles.
Hi, guys. You were talking about music giants kind of behind the scene. I have a friend, Bob Burton, that's working on a documentary about a man named Henry Louis. And this is a producer, engineer. And listen to the list of people he worked with. He did all of Joni Mitchell's music, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Joe Cocker, Van Morrison, The Doors, Leonard Cohen, and so on. I mean, this guy, he would never do a public interview. He shunned any kind of publicity at all. He's now passed away, but, you know, he lived his whole life in obscurity next to these giants, and it's just amazing, you know, the type of personality. You don't seem to see it today. Everybody is definitely tooting their horn, and it is fascinating what you're talking about.
All right. Thanks for that, Silverman. Appreciate it. Tooting their horn, or at least tweeting their events going on.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the case. You know, and it's not exclusive to social media, but I do make the case that social media, to a large degree, I think, is amplifying what is already kind of a tendency that we have. You know, and Jeff, you mentioned something earlier about, you know, in America versus the rest of the world. And in part of the book, I talk about and how invisibles, as I define them here, how this invisible work and these value set is looked at differently in different parts of the world and in different cultures. So, and, you know, I spoke with various academics in different parts of the world and consultants for businesses who operate in different places. You know, so one of the people I spoke with, this woman who's a consultant for businesses who have offices in Russia, but, you know, whose base is elsewhere, and she consults with, you know, these big kind of, you know, Fortune 500 companies and others. And she said, you know, one thing that I found really interesting was that in Russia, it's considered not really normal to just pop into your boss's office. But in the States, that's like the norm, you know, kind of the open door policy, everyone come in. And, you know, we think that that's a good thing. And there is an element of that that's great. But what we forget is that there are a lot of people who don't want to do that, who don't feel comfortable always popping into the boss's office. And what happens is when that becomes the norm of the culture in your workspace, where everyone's kind of expected to be pushing themselves and everyone, that person who's always like CCing the boss and everyone else in their office every time they do something, that it creates this sort of arms race where everyone feels compelled to be spending time and thought toward always making themselves known. And it's an arms race, of course, that's not winnable. And we'd be far better off when there's a broader culture at large, and then even specific to different organizations, where that is a little bit more frowned upon, where maybe there's specific set times where you can talk about your work, and the rest of the time, just do your work, and then there's not this pressure, this sort of competition for people to gain more and more attention over each other.
So we've talked about fact checkers for journalism organs, particularly in magazines. We've talked about the wayfinding, helping people find their way through airports. We've talked about the structural engineers. I love what an anesthesiologist says in the book. He describes his work as the San Andreas specialty.
We only get noticed when it's our fault.
Exactly.
Or it's always our fault. So, yeah. Good old anesthesiologist humor. Yeah, I mean, now listen, the thing about anesthesiologists, we all are familiar with what they do. So it's not that they're obscure in the way that a wayfinding expert is, who I, you know, talk about in the book. But when you think about it, you're never going to forget the name of that surgeon who, you know, removes your gallbladder or something. But most people, as soon as you're out of recovery, you're never going to remember that anesthesiologist. And yet, as anyone who works in a hospital and in surgery knows, that the anesthesiologists run the OR. Your life literally is in their hands. And they're only thought of if something goes horribly wrong. It's the only time the patient or the patient's, you know, family is ever going to be aware of the anesthesiologist. When they do their job perfectly, or even better than perfect, when they solve a disaster and everything's averted, most of the time we won't even know, and you just never think of them. And yet, one of the anesthesiologists had a great line in the book. He said, "You don't go into anesthesiology if you want a fruit basket sent to you. You know, that's for the surgeons. Let them get all the accolades. These guys work behind the scenes." And again, it's this notion of kind of savoring the power. They have an enormously powerful role in what's happening in the operating suite, and yet they really get no credit for that role outside of, you know, the medical, you know, community and the people working with them there. Never thinks of them.
It takes a certain kind of person, I'm thinking, and certainly a person with a certain mindset and a sense of humor to match that. The San Andreas specialty, I think, is a good indication of that. But my wife, before surgery, the anesthesiologist shook her hand and said, "Once you know me, you won't know much."
That's right. Exactly. The Sandman. So, I mean, that's this mentality. And, you know, again, these are people that one of the people I profiled in the book was one of the anesthesiologists. This is a guy who went to an Ivy League school and then an Ivy League medical school. He's at a top university hospital in California. This is someone who had a lot of options in his life. Both he could have gone into surgery or other more high-profile elements of medicine or in something else entirely. Yet he chose a role that was behind the scenes because something about it stimulated him, the intellectual challenge or whatever else it is about the job. And that's something that I think we all sense on an intuitive level. We all know that that's really what's going to bring us lasting reward, the value of our work, more than kind of the volume of praise we get. We sense this, but I think this sense largely gets lost living in it, just in the culture that we're in today. And what the book tries to do, what I hope it does, through these really long-form profiles, where you're really there with these people, you're at the tower in Shanghai, you're there in the airport. One of the people in the book is the guitar tech for Radiohead, and I meet up with them on tour in Europe, and you're there behind the stage and eventually on stage, right, literally in the shadows with their chief guitar tech who's been with them for over 20 years. So you're with all these people in these places, and what I hope is that by really being absorbed in the narratives of this awesome work that these people do in these kind of hidden worlds, that when you're immersed in this page after page in a book and these really fun stories, that in some way can try to offset the larger narrative that we're being told today. You know, it's one thing to just tell someone this, like I'm saying it to you here on the radio, but it's something else when you're immersed in the story. That's really the only way to combat this kind of like broader ethos today that's being pounded into us about the need for attention and what it's going to do for you.
And, you know, I mean, these jobs are they involve some intricacy, certainly, but none of them, I think, as brain-bustingly hard, potentially, as the job of interpreter. And you got to spend some time in the rooms at the United Nations with the interpreters. What was that like?
Yeah, it was really remarkable. A woman named Julia Wilkins RE, who's one of the elite interpreters at the United Nations, I was able to get into the interpreter's booth with her. I was at a closed-door meeting of the Disarmament Council. You know, this is a place where the media are basically never allowed. And this is something, that, again, that points to the notion of the power that these behind-the-scenes people have, that I was able to gain access to a world. There was no official transcript of the meeting that I was at. You know, things like that. I'm there, and her role is to listen to one language while someone is speaking and then translate it in her mind and then at the same time speak in a different language. And you don't stop. You know, there's no taking a break. As long as someone is speaking, you are translating in your head, interpreting it, and then speaking a different language. So, I mean, I get into some of the neuroscience about what's happening and these different studies. There was a study that compared the mental toughness that's required and the strain on the body and the brain of interpreters is equal to soldiers in the Israeli army. They said there is one study done. That's how they are only allowed to do half-hour shifts because the work is just so extraordinarily taxing that they do. Really amazing behind-the-scenes stuff. And yet her role, the whole point of her job, is to basically be this neutral conduit for one nation to communicate with another. If everything goes well, no one ever thinks of the interpreter. They are there. They're literally in like a booth. They don't even put them in the room usually. They're there off to the side. But without them, it's not hyperbole to say that the UN would grind to a halt, you know. But these people are critical. They're essential. Without them, the place wouldn't even work. And so for her, joy, her fulfillment comes in from the challenge of the work itself. That's what brings a reward, not anyone noticing her.
And there is a reason they're called interpreters and not translators, because they're not just doing a word for word. They actually have to figure out what the meaning of what a person's saying is. And as you point out, there are things like word ratio, or the fact that in French you don't tend to use acronyms like American English does. And so you have to cram all this stuff in there while you're listening, talking while you're listening, thinking and talking while you're listening. It's just an amazing set of skills. Let's go to Daryl in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Zweig. His book is Invisibles.
Hello, great topic. I'm really loving the conversation. I'm not that young. I'm 61, so I'm going back like 30 years ago. So it's a multi-generational thing, I guess. But I noticed I never needed thank yous for my work. And I noticed, like I say, 30 years ago probably, the younger people then seemed to need the supervisor to compliment them or get attention somehow. And or as long as I didn't get attention, I figured I was doing my job okay. Everything was kosher. And I'm wondering what the basic insecurity is that causes people to need that, and if it was something societal that came up.
Or generational, as you point out. Thanks for
yep.
that, Daryl. Appreciate
okay.
it.
Thank you.
David, your thoughts on generational differences?
Now, the caller has a really great point, and I trace that through history, you know, in the States, and you can see how largely how it mirrors this kind of rise of the individual in our culture. This we live in, it won't surprise anyone, we live in what psychologists consider the most individualistic culture in the world, whereas other cultures, what they call in the Confucian Belt, places like parts of China and Korea and elsewhere, that have a more collectivist attitude, where people's whole perspective, the whole prism with through in which they see the world, is different in America than it is in other places. So this notion that we think it's intrinsic to always want to say, oh, that's just natural, everyone wants attention. Well, that's not actually the case. And what we see that things that we think are just, quote, human nature, oftentimes aren't. Oftentimes we all live in such a bubble of our own worlds that we don't realize sometimes how different people can live, that even things that feel natural actually aren't necessarily natural, that they are a construct of the culture we live in. So I trace it. One of the fun things I make an example is of sports uniforms, and you can look back in the early 1960s, prior to that point in time, every major sports league, none of the players had their names on their shirts. And then it started around the 1960 or so that in Major League Baseball, teams started adding the players' names on their jerseys, and slowly all the other big sports franchise, you know, the NFL and whatever else, they are all started following suit. And to the point that today, everyone has their names on their shirts. And you can trace that as a real direct parallel to the rise of the individual in our culture. This notion of kind of subjugating oneself to something larger is really become lost. But here's a funny and interesting thought experiment. If you look at the few teams that tend to not have names on their jerseys, if you think about the Yankees or the Red Sox recently, at least with their success, you look at least prior to the scandal, Penn State for many years, Notre Dame, and I think it's the Dodgers who in the past 10 years won the World Series twice after they started doing no names on their uniforms. So it is an interesting thought experiment about the power of this more collectivist attitude towards success.
You know, one of the final examples in the book, too, about is when the invisible becomes visible, and just think hanging chads, and I'll leave it at that. David Zweig, a pleasure to have you here to talk about your book, Invisibles.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
All right, take care.